Thank you very much, Michael, and I'm very, very grateful to you for being the chair and for being willing to take Jim's place at short notice, and I'm sorry Jim isn't here himself. And I do want to say thank you to the Dewey people for arranging this. I've always been fascinated by reading other people's Dewey lectures, and writing my own has made me think about my own life as a philosopher and also about the way things have changed in philosophy over the years since I first grasped that there was such a thing as philosophy. So doing the Dewey lecture has been as fascinating to me as reading other people's lectures, and so that's why I'm very, very grateful to the Dewey Foundation for having invited me today. So the first part of my talk today is about why it's the reflections of a dinosaur. Philosophers who teach at colleges and universities and who don't have PhDs are a kind of dinosaur. We were widespread, but there are only a few of us left, and soon we will all have died out. So what I have today in the lecture is a few reflections in the light of our upcoming extinction. I begin with some general reflections about dinosaurhood, and in the middle of the lecture, I set out what kind of dinosaur I am and how I became that sort of dinosaur, and then I return to the general subject about dinosaurs at the end. Philosophers who are not dinosaurs, the ones who have PhDs or who are on the way to getting them, I call doctors, and I thought of calling you all octopuses, after William James's essay that some of you may know. James objected to the PhD octopus taking over American academia. But the octopus he was talking about was the system, not people with PhDs. People my age with PhDs I will call Dr. Codgers. So I will first describe the varieties of dinosaur, our resemblances and also differences among us. And then that will put me into a position to talk about resistance to the octopus and the defeat of the resistance. First then, varieties of dinosaurs and our common traits. While there are great differences among dinosaurs, there are some general resemblances. When we were young dinosaurs, just beginning to teach philosophy, we were not under pressure to publish things, and we are, on the whole, less specialized than are the doctors. And while this marks a very deep difference between us dinosaurs and present-day doctors, it doesn't actually distinguish us sharply from Dr. Codgers. Many Dr. Codgers now in their 70s or 80s were not under great pressure to publish when they started out teaching philosophy, nor were they pushed to identify themselves as specialists in any particular field. Like old dinosaurs, old doctors may never have had a CV until recently, if at all. They may never have had to label themselves as having an AOS. When they were young, those letters meant nothing. This has to do with both the professionalization of philosophy and the marketing of philosophers. I can mention this only briefly, although it is the background to pretty much everything I will be talking about. First then, varieties of dinosaur. Some American dinosaurs were hatched in the Harvard Society of Fellows, with only, as far as I know, two surviving examples, Marshall Cohen and Saul Kripke. William James himself counted as an odd sort of dinosaur in that he had a doctoral degree but in medicine. Many more species of dinosaurs flourished in the United Kingdom and the Commonwealth. First, there were, and this is the sort of oldest variety of dinosaur, there are dinosaurs who started teaching philosophy with only an undergraduate degree. That kind of dinosaur used to be extremely common, and there are still some surviving examples, including David Wiggins would be an example. Well-known older ones would be both Moore and Russell. Another species of dinosaur has an undergraduate degree in philosophy, say from a university in Scotland or in one of the Commonwealth countries, and then takes a second undergraduate degree. Most commonly, this was Grates at Oxford, and a surviving example of this sort of dinosaur is John McDowell. Ryle got a first in Grates and then another in PPE, and so he can count as a two undergraduate degree dinosaur. And another very important one is Wilfred Sellers. After his undergraduate degree at Michigan, Sellers completed a second undergraduate degree at Oxford. He then began doing a DPhil and stopped, and then he also began a PhD at Harvard and didn't finish. So he is, as it were, doubly a non-doctor. The most common sort of dinosaur in the mid-years of the 20th century were BPhil dinosaurs. This is dinosaurs that took the degree invented by Gilbert Ryle and John Mabbutt. Mabbutt and Ryle thought that research degrees like the DPhil and the BLitt were not well designed for people who had an undergraduate degree and wanted to do more philosophy and might possibly go on to teach philosophy. The BPhil was meant to work well for people who went on to have philosophy as their job, and it turned out to be extremely popular. Ryle frequently talked to BPhil students about the stupidity, as he saw it, of doctoral degrees, and particularly the ill-suitedness for graduate philosophy students of the kind of research projects which doctoral degrees involved. We BPhil dinosaurs were ourselves quite various. We had quite different approaches to philosophy and followed out all sorts of interests. I will just list a few of us, which brings out some of the variety. Annette Beyer, Jenny Teichman, Ruby Meager, Jack Smart, Peter Singer, Elizabeth Telfer, Peter Winch, Jerry Cohen, Jonathan Bennett, Richard Sarabji, Alan Donegan, Hans Sluga, David McNaughton, Dorothy Edgington, Gabrielle Taylor, Andre Galois, Richard Swinburne, Eric Matthews, Andrew Harrison, Patricia Churchland, William Abraham, and A. Phillips Griffiths. They do have really relatively little in common. You can call them all analytical philosophers of one sort or another. There is pretty generally, probably more than half have some interest in history of philosophy, but there's not really that much that they all have in common. Finally, the fourth and least common species of UK dinosaur took a graduate degree in philosophy, but neither a doctorate nor the BPhil. And Alistair MacIntyre is this kind of dinosaur, one of the, I suspect, few surviving examples of this sort of dinosaur. Anyway, that's about the varieties of dinosaur. And part three of my lecture now is about how the octopus strengthened its hold on philosophy by consuming the resistance. I discuss two episodes in which the octopus ate the resistance. In this country, the most important form of resistance to the octopus was the Harvard Society of Fellows. It had been thought up by Lawrence Lowell, who was president of Harvard early in the 20th century, together with L.J. Henderson, who was a biochemist. Lowell and Henderson had been influenced by James's attack on the PhD octopus. They thought that the PhD was all right in its place, but was not suited to the development of really outstanding minds. It merely encouraged the general run of competent scholarship and research. Lowell and Henderson wanted to set up something at Harvard, more or less like the prize fellowships at Trinity College, Cambridge. And previous holders of these Cambridge Trinity Prize fellowships were Whitehead, Russell, and Moore. And Whitehead was a personal friend of both Lowell's and Henderson's. When Lowell and Henderson set up the Society of Fellows, a junior fellowship provided 3 or 6 years of time for brilliant young men to follow whatever paths of thought they wanted and to stimulate each other's thought. They were not allowed to be reading for a degree. They were indeed intended to exemplify the lack of need for the PhD, although some of the fellows had already taken a PhD before they were elected to the Society of Fellows. But the Society of Fellows has been taken over by the octopus. The junior fellows are now simply prestigious postdocs, and nominations to the Harvard Society Fellows frequently come from someone's doctoral supervisor. There is no hint left of the original anti-octopusism. The main resistance to the octopus in the UK had been Ryle's and Mabbutt's invention of the BPhil degree. It had been meant as a much better degree for anyone wanting to teach philosophy than either the B.Lit or the D.Phil. And in the UK back then, the D.Phil had not even begun to be regarded as a basic qualification for university teaching. It was thought of largely as a degree for Americans. But things have changed, and the B.Phil has turned into a pre-doctoral program. If you go and look at the B.Phil website, it is described as a pre-doctoral program. And the tentacles of the octopus have reached even more deeply into British academic life. The B.Phil is no longer a qualification for an academic position in philosophy in Britain. In relation to the B.Phil, the octopus won in two ways. It turned an un-PhD program into a pre-PhD program, and it also wiped out the status that the B.Phil had as a qualification for teaching in the university. In summary then, the basic thing that happened in America and the UK, and as far as I know in the Commonwealth as well, was that there were no longer any university teaching jobs available to anyone without a PhD. That's the octopus. And it turned degrees or programs that hadn't been in its grasp into degrees or programs that came before the PhD or that came after it. And that's what you see with the B.Phil and the Harvard Society of Fellows. But mightn't someone ask that, you know, wouldn't somebody be a better university teacher with a B.Phil and a doctorate than with just the B.Phil? But what sort of comparison is appropriate here? If you have on one side of a comparison the philosopher who has a B.Phil and a PhD, you would need to compare her with someone who has a B.Phil followed by, let's say, 3 years of experience as a full-time university teacher. She has had to put together new classes. She has had to rethink many things she thought she knew. She's been growing as a philosopher over those years, and it's not obvious that she would be less qualified as a teacher of philosophy at the end of those years than someone who had spent that time in a PhD program, with a very substantial amount of the time having gone to research for the dissertation and to writing it. I will get back to this question later. One further point should be mentioned here, namely the tightening of the grip of the octopus on American academic life after around 1970. It used to be possible for someone to be hired at a college or university before finishing the PhD and then to finish it later. It is now normal for there to be a requirement that a job candidate in philosophy have already finished a PhD or that he be on track to complete it by the beginning of the appointment. And I will get back to this in part 9. Anyway, part 4 is about becoming a dinosaur. I grew up in New York. My family was Jewish, and my parents were school teachers. All 4 of my grandparents had been immigrants. My father's father was an anarchist, my mother and father were communists, and my father lost his job during the McCarthy years. My first philosophical publication was a poem in the progressive New York newspaper PM. I was 10 or 11, and the argument in the poem was that anti-vivisectionists were responsible for the deaths of people who would have lived had animal experiments not been thwarted by the anti-vivisectionists. As a child, I was also interested in the question whether my green was the same as or different from what other people were aware of when they saw something that we both called green. And I was also fascinated by the necessary unalterability of the past. But I first came into contact with philosophy as something you actually study in my second year at Swarthmore, when I took a wonderful class taught by Munro Beardsley and Dick Rudner. Philosophy seemed to me to be a great subject because you didn't need to read anything, that's what I thought. All you needed to do was to think hard about the problems. I think many, many philosophers, when they start, think that that's all they have to do. Anyway, I was under pressure from my parents to major in a subject which would be useful later, so I majored in mathematics. But I did take 2 philosophy seminars, one in philosophy of science and one in symbolic logic. In my last year at Swarthmore, I applied to graduate schools in economics again with the idea that I should study something that could earn me a living later. I went off to MIT in the fall of 1957 to do economics. MIT didn't then have anyone teaching philosophy. But MIT students could take classes at Harvard in any subject that wasn't taught at MIT. And Paul Grice was visiting Harvard that year, and he taught a seminar on meaning, implication, logical form, and the categories. I had no idea what a category was supposed to be or what logical form was. And in fact, Grice never got to that. He never really got beyond the meaning and implication bits. But anyway, the seminar itself was a great experience. And Quine came, and that was a particularly wonderful part of it. How I managed to get a grade of B+ on that, I have no idea. I also took a seminar on political philosophy with Morton White. And by the end of that year at MIT, I knew I didn't want to do more economics. I wanted to work for a year while living at home to save money, and then go to live and study philosophy in Oxford for 2 years. You can't do that anymore. I was enormously lucky to have wanted to go to Oxford at a time when tuition was extremely low, and not only for, and it was low even for overseas students. They raised it first for overseas people and then raised it for everybody. At that time, it was terrifically cheap, and you could live also very cheaply in Oxford. If you tried to do this now, I did an estimate of what it would cost you, and I think it would cost for 2 years upwards of $90,000. Someone as unskilled as I then was, with nothing but a BA, could have no hope of saving that much money while working for 1 year. Anyway, I worked for most of the year 1958-59 at IBM, which trained me as a programmer. I worked on the debugging program for the 709 computer, which was what they were developing at that time. And IBM, which was very generous about paying for classes you were taking, IBM paid for me to go to a class that was being taught at night at NYU by Stephen Toulmin on ethics. In the fall of 1959, I went to Oxford on leave of absence from IBM, so I had a job to go back to if I wanted. I was extraordinarily lucky, as it turned out, in another way. I was planning to read PPE when I went to Oxford, and I did spend one term doing philosophy and politics, but after that, I really did not want to do economics. And I'm not sure how this all was arranged, but I was able to switch immediately after that first term to doing the BPhil. And this would be impossible now. To get into the BPhil program, you have to apply by January of the previous year, and you need to already have a good undergraduate degree in philosophy or be predicted to be about to get one in the summer. You need to submit a writing sample, a CV, and a transcript. It's all bureaucratized the way these things are. Anyway, there was none of that, and so I began the path to BPhil dinosaurhood with Paul Grice as my tutor. The BPhil was then a terrifying program, because at the end, you took 3 exams and submitted a short thesis, and you passed or you failed, and that was that. Everyone knew very good philosophers who had failed. To my great surprise, I passed. I actually had a bottle of wine writing on that. I was so sure I was going to fail. But anyway, I bet I would fail and lost. Before the exams, Ryle asked me if I was interested in a temporary position at the University College of Swansea the following year. As far as I know, if I recall this right, he recommended 2 of us, with the idea that the people at Swansea could choose one or the other. I hadn't realized that my presentation in Ryle's seminar not long before had been, in a sense, a job talk. I was offered the job at Swansea and took it. So I wasn't any longer a computer programmer on leave. I was a newly hatched dinosaur. Getting a job without applying for it wasn't something that was distinctive of dinosaurs, though. This was also how many Dr. Codgers got their first job. Barry Stroud writes about this in his Dewey lecture. As he says, this is one of the ways in which we who began teaching back then were lucky. But what was distinctive about us dinosaurs in the UK was that it was Ryle who sent us off to this or that job. There was only the one program in the UK, the BPhil, designed for people who might want to teach philosophy. And so it was Ryle who was asked to recommend people for the teaching positions that opened up. Say one of the Scots universities needed someone who could do Kant, and the professor there would write to Ryle. And that's how it worked. And Ryle would sort of think this person would go well there, and so on. And often it was a matter of the person not being at all like the people who were there already. He thought, you know, he thought, oh, well, this, he's unlike them, but this is in a good way, and this would work well. Anyway, looking back at my time now in the BPhil program, the best thing about it, as far as I'm concerned, the thing that mattered most to me afterwards was the tutorials with Paul Grice. He didn't let you get away with the kinds of things you might simply take to be obvious. He didn't let you get away with anything. And I can't imagine, actually, a better philosophical education than what I had in Oxford. The next three sections are on my early dinosaurhood. So section five is early dinosaurhood, thinking, talking, and teaching. During my first year at Oxford, I met Michael Feldman, another philosophy student. We began to live together the following year, and we married in 1965. How I see philosophy even today was shaped by discussions with Michael, and also by the time we spent out in the countryside, first around Oxford, and then when I was at Swansea, out on the Gower Peninsula. The Swansea position was a temporary one, and the following year I taught at the New University of Sussex. But Michael and I wanted to be further from the noise and traffic and suburban development around Brighton, and so I applied for and got a position at the University of Aberdeen, starting in the fall of 1963. In those first 3 years of teaching at Swansea and Sussex and Aberdeen, I taught a great variety of different classes, Rousseau and logic, the English moralists and social philosophy, and lots else. Although I also had a couple of research projects, I was under no pressure to publish. If I had been, it's quite possible I could have turned out something on the things I was then working on, the paradoxes of entailment or Strawson on persons. But it was good, I think, that I didn't have to try to publish anything, and I'm quite sure philosophy has lost nothing by the non-existence of those papers. Some philosophers can relatively quickly find their way into what they want and need to say. Others take longer. In her Dewey lecture, Ruth Millikan argued strongly against forcing early and continuous publication in philosophy. Her account came out of her certainty that she, quote, could never have become a philosopher in the current environment. Whether or not I could have done so, I certainly could not have become the philosopher I did become. I'll sketch how that happened, and I'll get back later to the questions that Ruth Millikan raised. Section six, early dinosaurhood, becoming a Wittgensteinian dinosaur. I had read Remarks on the Foundations of Mathematics when I was an undergraduate, but with no real understanding. Then at Oxford, I went to Elizabeth Anscombe's class on the investigations, but understood very little. 2 years later, when I was at Swansea, there were more people there doing philosophy in the light of Wittgenstein's work than there were in any other UK department. But I found what they were doing mystifying, no less so at the end of my year there. But then one afternoon, the following October, when I had just started teaching at the University of Sussex, my colleague Ivor Hunt came over to the village where I was living, greatly excited. The most remarkable article had just been published, and I had to read it right away. This was Stanley Cavell's essay on the availability of Wittgenstein's later philosophy. It remains a wonderfully exciting work, conveying with great power and immediacy what Cavell took to be important and to have been missed in Wittgenstein, in what Wittgenstein was doing. But what would be the way to get hold of this? Michael and I thought we needed to try to read and understand the Tractatus first. So, in the summer of 1965, we took the Tractatus with us, with what little luggage we could carry, to a hut in Norway. We also had Max Black's commentary and Elizabeth Anscombe's introduction to Wittgenstein's Tractatus, and we worked through the Tractatus as best we could over 3 months. The following summer, we took the investigations with us to Norway and read it over 3 months there. Very fortunately, this period of reading Wittgenstein coincided with the opportunity I had at the University of Aberdeen to co-teach an honors class on Wittgenstein with Guy Stock and Michael Clark. And this was really wonderful, as neither Michael nor Guy nor I took ourselves to be experts on Wittgenstein. We were trying to understand his thought, working things out in discussion with each other and with the students, and we were able to do this twice. In 1966, I was asked to reply to a paper that Michael Clark gave to the Scots Philosophical Club. His paper was on self-deception, and he defended a kind of literalist view. In my reply, I tried to shift away from his conception of the problem about whether one can or can't deceive oneself, and to examine what it is to use the language of two-person deception in speaking of a single individual. I was drawing on what I had been reading of Wittgenstein, but not just the investigations. Wittgenstein's lecture on ethics had just been published, and then in 1966, his lectures and conversations on aesthetics, religion, and psychology came out. I was trying to see connections between how one might think of self-deception and some of the strands in Wittgenstein's thought, including the newly published material. When I was invited soon after that to present a paper to the Aristotelian Society, what I wrote developed out of those ideas. And that's where my Wittgensteinian dinosaurhood first emerged in the paper's secondary sense. That led to my getting involved in a very different project. I was trying to take further some of the ideas in secondary sense, and I sent what I had written to Rush Rees, who had been a colleague of mine in Swansea. He invited me to work with him on a volume that would include material from Wittgenstein's notebooks from 1934-5, together with students' notes from Wittgenstein's lectures that year. While we were working on this, Rees gave me 4 sets of notes taken by students at Wittgenstein's 1939 lectures on the foundations of mathematics. The idea was that if I could make anything out of them, we might publish a version of those notes together with the notes from 1934-5. And what happened was that in the end, we dropped the idea of publishing the 1934-5 material, and after some experimentation, I worked out how to handle the 4 sets of notes from the 1939 lectures. The work with those notes took a long time. It took about 4 years of immersion into what was, in fact, 62 hours of Wittgenstein's lectures, time that had been captured more or less well by the students. I needed to learn to hear Wittgenstein's voice as it came out, sometimes quite muffled, but sometimes sharply clear in the notes. And I think I gained enormously from having had the chance to do that editing. I was quite a slow developing Wittgensteinian dinosaur. It took a long time before I began to write about the Tractatus or about Frege. What made me start was thinking about Elizabeth Anscombe's essay, The Reality of the Past. She was concerned with the idea we may have that changing the past is something we can't do. Drawing on remarks of Wittgenstein's, she lays out a response to that idea and brings out the difference between the sentence, the past cannot change, and statements of physical impossibility. Her argument emphasizes what we don't have. We don't have ways of talking about when or how such and such a change occurred in the past, or about what brought about the change, how the change played out, and so on. We don't have a use for such ways of speaking. Talk of a change in the past, in our circumstances, has no sense. It doesn't mean something that can't be done, it means nothing. I wondered whether the view that Anscombe had heard Wittgenstein expressing about this sort of case could be found much earlier in his thought in the Tractatus, and whether there was anything at all similar in Frege. I wanted to find out whether the approach sketched by Anscombe was connected with fundamental ideas of Wittgenstein's and Frege's, like the context principle. What I went on to do in reading early Wittgenstein comes from following out that question. If you look at the so-called resolute reading of the Tractatus, that kind of reading of early Wittgenstein comes from what I would say is already in Anscombe's discussion of later Wittgenstein in The Reality of the Past. My Wittgensteinian dinosaurian development was, however, still noticeably stunted. When I wrote about early Wittgenstein, I had steered clear of what he was apparently saying, or maybe not saying, about ethics. I just left ethics alone, as various other people. Mari McGinn has a book on the Tractatus that doesn't say anything. People often don't want to have anything. They're not clear what they want to say, and so they don't say anything. And that's where I was. I needed a push. The push came from Jim Conant, who was then finishing his PhD at Harvard. Back in the early days of emails, it was lengthy emails from Jim that led me to take up the whole question of what Wittgenstein was up to in relation to ethics in the Tractatus. Section 7 now is called A Vegetarian Dinosaur Too. I won't go into details of how I became a vegetarian dinosaur, but it led me to start thinking about human beings in relation to animals, and that led to a U-turn from my long-ago defense of the vivisectionists. I first wrote about animals and human beings in Eating Meat and Eating People, and I'm still defending one of the arguments that I put forward in Eating Meat and Eating People, that in ethics, we shouldn't be taken in by a spurious conception of what genuine impartiality demands of us. So that's been a main theme of my papers in ethics. In ethics, though, I've also been deeply influenced by some of Iris Murdoch's work. Section 8 is called The Expat Dinosaur Returns and Some Other Significant Things in My Dinosaurhood. In 1969, I had a visiting appointment at the University of Virginia. Up until then, I'd been at Aberdeen, I'd been at Oxford, then Swansea, then Sussex, then Aberdeen. Up until 1969, I had no sense of what had been going on all those years in America. When I had left, Eisenhower was president. Returning 10 years later, I had become a kind of Rip Van Winkle, as the country, I had missed all of Kennedy and all of LBJ. I had become a sort of Rip Van Winkle as the country had changed almost unrecognizably during the 60s. Michael and I found ourselves in a country in turmoil about the Vietnam War, turmoil which engulfed colleges and universities. The whole year was a shock. The following year, I was back at the university in Aberdeen, but we had been very moved by the cares and concerns of friends and students and colleagues in Virginia. My family, too, had been involved in protests against the war. In the spring of 1971, when I was offered a permanent position at Virginia, I accepted it, and Michael and I moved to Charlottesville a few months later. A few years later than that, in 1975, we separated. Skipping now to the summer of 1976, I was on sabbatical in Shetland, and my colleague Tony Woosley wrote to me about our possibly co-teaching a class on Hume. I wrote back, he wrote back, there were more letters, and Tony joined me in London in January 1977. Sometime later we married, and much of what we went on to do in philosophy from then on grew from talking things out together. When I moved back to America, I didn't know any American philosophers outside the Virginia department. I hadn't been an American philosopher before I left, and I can't say I really became one until later. But much of what I have been able to do in philosophy since coming back has depended on friends I have made here. One good friend was Dick Rorty, colleague and neighbor and holder of Outrageous Views, which I have tried to respond to over the years. I also came to know some of the denizens of Emerson Hall, and the currents of philosophical thought swirling around there have in many ways shaped what I've written about Frege and Wittgenstein and ethics. So my thinking was affected by people whose thinking was affected by each other, and so I can't say what I owe to whom. But I am anyway indebted to Hilary Putnam, Juliet Floyd, Warren Goldfarb, Tom Ricketts, Joan Weiner, Alice Crary, Peter Hilton, Martha Nussbaum, Bert Drebin, Stanley Cavell and Jim Conant, whom I mentioned a bit earlier, and with whom I have worked closely ever since we first met. As a philosopher, I'm deeply dependent on things I have read or that people have said to me, including comments and suggestions. And so I feel enormous gratitude to students and friends who have said this or that to me or sent me comments, or who have been anonymous reviewers of things I've written. Much of the book that I have coming out in February comes from two thought germs, one being Anscombe's discussion of a remark, the contradictory of which peters out into nothingness, and one being a remark by Jean-Philippe Nabou about the sense which remarks may have that are put forward in opposition to determinate forms of confusion. I'm also drawn on when I read something and sense that I need to understand better where and how I agree or disagree with the writer. I think, for example, of Sabina Loverbund and of David Wiggins and of what they've written about ethics and Wittgenstein and how much I've gained from thinking about that. Well, nine, back to reflections now on the disappearance of dinosaurs. I don't think that there is anything wrong with PhDs as such. I don't doubt at all that the experience of writing a PhD can be enormously valuable. And I also don't want to dispute that being a student in a good PhD program can be a great thing, that you can learn a lot of philosophy, and if you're lucky, you will have a chance to talk philosophy over a period of years with some amazing people. But that leaves open the question whether it should be a requirement for becoming a teacher of philosophy that you spend some years doing research for a dissertation, writing it up in the appropriate way, and passing the usual sort of examination on it. It isn't clear what can be said in favor of such a requirement. We can think about 20th century Anglophone philosophy as providing a kind of experiment in which many philosophers have a PhD and many philosophers don't, and we can compare them. But if you think of it as an experiment, it hardly shows that with is better than without or the other way around. I haven't ever seen an argument against Ryle's view that the doctorate doesn't do much to prepare someone for being a philosopher and teacher of philosophy compared with other possible ways for someone to get into being a philosopher. After Ryle and Mabbutt had set up the BPhil, they recognized that Americans might want to go on after the BPhil to get a doctorate because of the requirements for teaching in America. But Ryle would have regarded as ridiculous the general idea that for a teacher of philosophy, the BPhil should be followed by a doctorate. Well, we now take it for granted that people who want to teach philosophy must have a doctorate, nobody I've seen seems to have a reply to Ryle's sorts of argument or to William James's earlier ones. And I'll summarize four arguments on that side. First, while a dissertation project involving about 2 years or sometimes more of research and writing may work well for some people as a preparation for their future work in philosophy, there is no evidence that it is so valuable in general that it should be a required part of philosophical education, or that it is the only or the best way to determine whether someone is qualified to get a job in philosophy. Two, second argument. The choice of subject for a PhD dissertation is normally determined in part by what looks like a dissertable subject, but what counts as an acceptable subject for a dissertation may not fit in with the interests of the student. This was in fact one of Ryle's main points against the DPhil. A dissertable subject might well be a boring subject. It would be a subject that hadn't been worked over, often, as Ryle noted, for good reasons, and often would be quite narrow enough to be manageable in the allotted time for the project, and capable of being spelled out in advance in what would count as an acceptable proposal, a proposal that wasn't wildly unlike the general run of successful research proposals. And this connects with Lowell's and Henderson's view that the PhD encouraged a level of mere competence in research and scholarship. PhD requirements generate particular kinds of research. And even when they don't actually generate the research topic, The topic may nevertheless be given a particular understanding or a particular shape to make it fit as a dissertation subject. 3. Most people who write a dissertation are under, especially now, are under considerable pressure to get it done relatively quickly. And in response to such pressures, they may avoid risk. They may be disinclined to explore avenues of thought that might turn into dead ends, however promising those avenues may appear. They may be inclined to stick to current conventions of various sorts, including conventions about what belongs to the field of specialization, what needs to be cited to demonstrate mastery of the field, and so on. Once they have done a fair amount of work, they may feel they cannot afford to re-examine any of the fundamental ideas of the dissertation. When we think about such pressures, we can see the significance of the original prohibition on junior fellows working towards a graduate degree in the original setup of the Harvard Society of Fellows. The junior fellows were not to be fixated on getting it done. For 3 or 6 years, they were supposed to be thinking about a subject in circumstances which encouraged exploring ideas that might go somewhere but that might not, without fear that such exploration might impede their progress towards a degree. Lowell and Henderson, in setting up the Society of Fellows, were plainly responding to a danger they saw in the dominance of the PhD, the distortion of graduate education by having as its centerpiece the getting done of a job qualification. But none of what I've said here about pressures to, the bad thing about pressures to get it done, none of this implies that there is never good reason to tell a student that maybe she should get rid of this or that chunk and write a conclusion and hand the thing in, whether the thing in question is a PhD or a BPhil or any other piece of work. Sometimes you do need to say, just get it done. Well, anyway, fourth argument about PhDs. William James used the image of the octopus for the PhD system taking over American universities. But he also had the image of a tyrannical machine, a machine which, among other things, excludes talented people from academic life. And the machine has, if anything, become more tyrannical since 1903, when William James was writing. Think about what was going on, let's say, in 1946, more tyrannical even than then. In 1946, Wilfred Sellers was 34. He had no PhD and no likelihood of getting one, and he had published nothing. But Herbert Feigl got him a job at Minnesota. Feigl was a full professor there, and he could go and tell the dean, I presume this is something like this happened, he could go and tell the dean that the Minnesota department would greatly benefit by hiring the remarkably promising young Wilfred Sellers, despite his having no PhD. But that was 70 years ago, and any Feigl today would know that even if he came across a 21st century Sellers, there is no way you could get a dean to hire him. So the tyrannical PhD machine of today would exclude Sellers, and we wouldn't have that 21st century Sellers' contributions to philosophy. The PhD machine of today would also make problems for Thompson Clark, since the machine now requires that young philosophers have finished the PhD by the time they start on a tenure-track position. If we have Thompson Clark's contribution to our thinking about skepticism, that's only because the PhD machine in the 1950s was less efficiently tyrannical than it is now. But the basic Jamesian argument here is that with more or less efficiency, the machine works to exclude people who might contribute greatly to philosophy. The argument generalizes. What you demand of young philosophers affects whom you get in the profession, whom you will have as your mature philosophers down the road, and whom you will have forced out of philosophy or discouraged at an early stage. This is indeed part of the argument that Ruth Millikan used against the demand for early and continuous publication by philosophers. As I mentioned in part 5, she says she herself could never have become a philosopher in the current environment, but her concern more generally is how that current environment alienates and excludes many of those whom we should particularly want to attract. Part 10, some final thoughts. It's difficult to think that the kind of career I had, and many other dinosaurs too, is no longer possible. This is only one of many recent changes in the whole business of philosophy. At the end now, I want to talk about one of the other changes. When we, dinosaurs and Dr. Codgers, were students, we didn't have to think of ourselves as on the way to being marketable young research producers. We didn't have to think about what would make us more or less marketable. We didn't have to figure out how to fit that kind of thought together in our minds with thinking about philosophy and trying to get deeper into what we were reading and thinking about. We never had to wonder whether whatever it was going to fit into an AOS or an AOC, or whether it was the sort of thing we should shut up about having any interest in. And our teachers and advisors weren't in the position that philosophy teachers and advisors are in these days, where they may have deep admiration and respect for philosophers who, if their students were like those philosophers and it showed in their CV, the students would be unmarketable. We, as teachers and advisors, are stuck, as our own teachers and advisors weren't, stuck trying on the one hand to encourage the kind of dedication and love of philosophy that it's wonderful to see among students, and trying on the other hand to help the students remain on track to becoming certifiable research producers who can actually get jobs without losing hold of what drew them to philosophy in the first place. Alistair MacIntyre, in his Dewey lecture, speaks of the double life we need to live if we are to work within and against the professionalization of philosophy. This is a hard thing, and I'll end by expressing my admiration for philosophers who keep at this with all its difficulty.
Good, yeah.
So